listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and pleased to be so. It's another beautiful Thursday this summer here in D.C. And as we speak, we were actually going to have a guest on, James Jones from D.C. Vote. DCVote.org is the website of the organization. And he was going to be on live from Andy Harris's office. Congressman Andy Harris, of course, the Republican from Maryland, who has decided that he really should run the City Council of Washington, D.C. And so he put a little change into the law, into an appropriations bill that said that D.C. couldn't actually decriminalize pot. And another Republican congressman put a similar change in, or same kind of amendment to a must-pass bill saying that D.C. couldn't have strict gun regulations. This while in the last week, two people have been busted trying to carry guns into the House office building, or one of the House office buildings. So you would think that, you know, the members of the House of Representatives would be saying, I don't know. I think the guys who've been busted have all been crazy right wingers. So what can you do? But anyhow, James is not with us. We will perhaps have him later in the day. But the report that Danielle got off Twitter was that the Capitol Police had moved in. And so our guest may be in jail right now. I can't tell you. Mike Papatonio is going to be with us in the third hour of our program today. Remember Thomas Ricks? I find this fascinating. It's kind of the question of what direction is America going? Are people waking up? How long does it take before the damage of Reaganomics and the reality of the caucus room conspiracy and Republican obstructionism, how long does it take before that kind of settles in with people and to people? How long does it take before they get it? And they go, you know, this really sucks. These right-wingers, they're nuts. Thomas Ricks is I don't have his whole CV. I should pull it up. But he used to write about security issues. And he just wrote this piece over in Politico. He's identified as a journalist who writes on defense topics. And it's titled, Why Am I Moving Left? Thomas E. Ricks. He says, in my late 50s, at a time when most people are supposed to be drifting into a cautious conservatism, I'm surprised to find myself moving steadily leftward. There's a nice, it's originally published at Politico. There's a nice clip of this summary of it over at democraticunderground.com. He says, since leaving newspapers, I have again and again found myself shifting to the left in major areas such as foreign policy, and domestic economic policy. I wonder whether others of my generation are similarly pausing, poking up their heads from their workplaces, and wondering just what happened to this country over the past 15 years and what to do about it. Well, first, Thomas, let me tell you, it's not 15 years. It's more like 33 years. It goes back to the inauguration of Ronald Reagan in January of 1981, 33 years ago today. And in some ways goes back before that, you know, the Nixon drug war, for example, which set the stage for massive incarceration, principally of minorities, but also selective enforcement of the laws so that drug laws could be used to take down people who are troublesome or activist. I mean, this goes back a long, long way. And I think people are waking up. Interesting piece over at Alternate. Big lie. America doesn't have the number one richest middle class in the world. Oh, really? We used to. Where are we? Well, we're number 27 in the world. 27 in middle class. We are the richest country in the world. We have the most millionaires. We have the most billionaires. We have the most very, very wealthy corporate executives of any other country in the world. And we have the most poor people and the most children in poverty of any developed country in the world. You could say, you know, welcome to third world America. Alabama and Mississippi are starting to look like Guatemala or Somalia. But the fact of the matter is that those states still have their millionaires and billionaires along with this dreadful, dreadful poverty. So what do we do about this? How do we respond to this? Well, Congressman Paul Ryan has been thinking real hard about this, and he's been out in kind of a low-profile way. Remember a couple of years ago, he and his wife showed up in a soup kitchen for a photo op. But he's been visiting nonprofits around the country who are doing good work at the local level. And I'm a big fan of the nonprofit sector doing good work. I'm on the board of one, the Hunter School. In fact, the local TV station in New Hampshire just did a really nice piece, which I think Lori's probably going to put up on the website over at hunterschool.org in the next couple of days, with a link to it. And Lisa Ling for the Oprah Network did a really nice piece too on the work that Hunter School is doing, and it's a private organization. But that doesn't mean that private organizations should take over government functions. You know, if the government is failing to meet a particular need or is unable to meet a particular need, I don't have a problem with private organizations stepping in. But what Paul Ryan has come up with is, let's take all these federal programs that are helping out people in need and turn them into block grants and give the money to the states and tell the states two things. One, A, you can do this any way you want, and B, you have to use as many private contractors as possible. And since a lot of the organizations, I mean, Hunter School is not religiously affiliated, although we are the original model for the Salem Children's Village in New Hampshire, which the Hunter School is, you know, they're one and the same. When we first started it back 30-some-odd years ago, when Louise and I first started it, it was a community for abused kids because there was that was the crisis in New Hampshire at the time. There were not enough foster homes. The foster homes that were not able to deal with the really, really damaged kids or the really violent kids. And the state basically only had two options for those kind of kids, the state mental hospital or the state children's prison. So we created a intermediary, place where kids could live in a family environment. Over the years, it's become, the school part of it has become the front and center part. But the organization in Germany that we based it on calls themselves a Christian organization. And, yeah, I think in our founding document, in our incorporation papers, we note that. But we are not a religious organization in any way. Our 501c3 exemption comes from being a school. But this pitch of Paul Ryan's is going to just open the floodgates for money to go to church-based organizations. And frankly, I mean, the corruption of these processes. He says, it's going to actually help poor people. I don't think so. I think what he's doing is he's extending the Republican criminalization of poverty. He's saying you must be working, first of all, to be eligible for this stuff. Well, a lot of people who are on these welfare programs are either elderly, children, or disabled people. In fact, more than half. So you got to be working. Right. And then, okay, you got to be working, but all our jobs are in, like, Vietnam. You got a solution for that? No, Paul Ryan believes in free trade. So if you're not, we're going to punish you. It's just, I think that, Thomas Ricks and others, as we see the ugly face of the Republican Party, the stupidity and hatred, people are just turning away from it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And aggressively so. By the way, I got a thing from free-don.org, Don Siegelman. I got to tell you about this. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jared watching Free Speech TV in Burlington, Vermont on the cable system there. Hey, Jared, what's up?
Tom, I'd like to refer to you mentioned yesterday the
Hippocampus.
Hippocampus.
Yeah.
My cousin got smashed in the back of his head. And, the hippopotamus or hippo, whatever, got badly damaged.
Yeah.
He's slowly regaining speech and locomotion. Mm-hmm. What you also talked about bilateral therapy. When I worked in Brazil, the samba, which is a syncopation of the bossa nova, which is a syncopation of the samba, it's basically bilateral. It's two steps to the left, two steps to the right.
Right.
Two steps to the left, two steps to the right.
Yep. And I think all of this stuff derives from indigenous dancing, which is very simply bilateral, at least that which I've seen both on Native American reservations and in Africa.
That's the point that you try to bring up. But anyway, your program was, as always, most interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. So, yeah, thank you for sharing that, Jared. I appreciate it. Whoop. I'm sorry. I dropped Jared apparently in mid-sentence. Cliff in Canyon Country, California. Hey, Cliff, what's up?
Good day, Tom.
Thanks for watching Free Speech TV, Cliff.
Yeah, my pleasure. My pleasure. Yesterday in your Green and Science report, you mentioned the dispersants that they dumped in the Gulf during the BP oil disaster. And we can't let this happen again and that we shouldn't have done it. But it was a collaboration between our EPA, BP, and the Coast Guard. I mean, they knew Corexit was banned in Europe. They knew it was extremely harmful and toxic. And they lied about the amounts they dumped, but they just wanted to remove the sheen on the surface because it was bad for business.
You're right.
And I think recently BP was granted a bunch of new permits to do some more drilling. I don't know if it's in the Gulf or other.
Yeah, they've been continuously being granted permits, and the Obama administration, the president, brags about it.
Are they still the number one supplier of oil for our military also?
BP? I don't know. I don't know.
You don't know?
I can tell you about the Corexit stuff, though. This is fascinating. Ellen Ratner, who is not without some resources, she runs a program down in Louisiana for people who were displaced by the Hurricane Katrina. And so she's very active down there in the Gulf Coast area, knows a lot of people. And when they started spraying Corexit on that oil spill, the guy who is the president of the medical school in Grenada, who's a personal friend of Ellen's, in fact, Louise and I met him again just a couple of days ago at a little fundraiser thing that Ellen invited us to. She just wanted to bring along a few friends, and so Louise and I went. That Nancy Pelosi was at, and a few other people, John Lewis, and he was there. And he immediately said to her, "This stuff is poison, and we need to get some of it. You know, the stuff that they're spraying, and analyze it." And Ellen had like a half a dozen people running around trying to get just an ounce of the stuff, and they couldn't. And, you know, just so that they could analyze it and say, here's what's in this chemical. And I've never seen a good chemical analysis of this stuff. So it's like apparently some kind of incredible top secret thing. I thought it would be easy to get. I mean, they were spraying billions of gallons or millions of gallons of it, but she was unable to do it. Cliff, thanks for the call. On the line with us, if I have this right. Yeah, hey, James Jones. I was mourning the possibility that you were in jail. James Jones with DC Votes, DCVote.org. James, welcome to the program.
Oh, great to be with you. And yeah, we're not there yet. We're not in jail yet, but you know, that's still an option.
Oh my. So give us the backstory.
Okay, well. As some of your listeners may know, the District of Columbia is treated really shabbily at times by members of Congress who we don't vote for. We have no vote in Congress. And Andy Harris in our neighboring state of Maryland, he recently passed legislation that took away any funding that we could spend, our local funds. These are local funds on decriminalization of marijuana. Mr. Harris put it in the appropriations bill that we couldn't spend our local funds. The sad fact in America today is that the District of Columbia remains more or less a colony in this regard, in that the Congress can do this to us. So today, if Mr. Harris has made the statement himself that Congress is the local legislature of the District of Columbia. That is an exact quote.
Hmm.
And so we said, well, if you're our legislature, can we just come in with our constituent complaints? And we lined up about 50 or 60 people who are concerned about potholes, about downed trees, maybe garbage pickup. And we lined up at his office and asked him to fix them. So this is, of course, not a serious thing. We just want him to know that if he wants to mess with us and claim to be this omnipotent legislator who doesn't have to answer to the people of the District of Columbia, that we can do some things to him as well to disrupt his life, his business life, in a way that he might find objectionable.
Well, I might cast it a little less maliciously, is too strong a word, but tit for tat, as if he wants to actually think that he's in charge of legislating for the district, fine, let him do that, but let him also take responsibility for filling the potholes and taking care of the rats we've got in our backyard, and, you know.
Yeah, right, exactly. That's the idea, but, you know, I wish it wasn't such a serious issue. I wish we were just having fun with it.
Yeah.
We are bringing a lot of attention to it, but it is offensive, despicable. I don't know what the word is when, you know, in America, you have a guy, and frankly, you know, the rest of his caucus, who believe that even though we have a local legislature that we vote for, that they can just overrule us.
Right.
I mean, it's absurd to think that in America that still exists. I know a lot of people know we don't have a vote in Congress, but fewer people know that Congress still has the ability to do whatever they want to us. So we have to push back the way we can, and we did it at his D.C. office today, and created quite a bit of disruption with no arrests. It was peaceful, and we petitioned our congressman, as he claims to be, with our problems, and you know, let him know that if he wants to continue doing this, we're going to continue coming in.
Yeah, and if people want to call Congressman Harris and express their thoughts on this, the switchboard number for Congress, and you just ask for Andy Harris's office, is 202-225-3121. You can use that number actually to reach any member of the House or Senate. It's the congressional switchboard. It's 202-225-3121. And if you live in the District of Columbia and you got a problem with roach infestations or whatever, I mean, you know, Andy Harris is your guy. 202-225-3121. We're talking with James Jones. He's the communications director for DCVote.org. There's a really serious issue here, James, and that is that the District of Columbia has more citizens in it than do either the states of Vermont or Wyoming, if my memory serves me correctly.
Right.
And yet has Eleanor Holmes Norton is our representative in the House of Representatives, but she does not have the power to vote. And up until the last generation, she did not even have the power to speak on the floor.
That's right.
That happened in my lifetime. I don't remember when. Maybe you can tell me.
Yeah, I am not the accurate historian on this one.
Yeah, I think it happened when I was a kid. So I think it probably happened back in the 60s, 70s, maybe even the early 80s. But she can speak on the floor, but she now, which is, you know, for 200 years she couldn't do, but she can't vote, and we have no senators. And whereas Wyoming and Vermont both have two senators. And so where does this stand? We have about a minute left. We're talking with James Jones with DCVote.org.
Where does it end?
Yeah, where does it stand? Is there any are there any serious efforts in Congress to establish statehood for the District of Columbia?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we have a statehood bill in the Senate. We're going to get a hearing on it before the end of the year, we think. Senator Tom Carper is the sponsor of that. It has all the Democratic leadership.
This does not require amending the Constitution?
That's a matter for people much more, you know, who know more about the Constitution than I do. Some people say yes, some people say no.
Right.
But yes, we are going to pursue the constitutional method approach as well, but that's a little bit longer term. But there are bills, but there's no hope that this is going to pass anytime soon. But in the meantime, we're just going to keep fighting for our own.
Yeah, and keep beating the drum and pointing out, hey, you know, this, you know, we, at the very least, the District of Columbia should have local home rule, should have autonomy. And but Andy Harris doesn't think so. His phone number is 202-225-3121. If you've got a problem or complaint about the District of Columbia, call Andy Harris. James Jones, thank you for being with us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
You can read all about what D.C. Vote is doing at dcvote.org. We'll be right back. People get their news. The Tom Hartman Program. Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back. And, there's a big story going on right now. The Prime Minister of the Ukraine has resigned. Ukrainian Prime Minister resigns as Kiev moves towards elections. When I first saw this story, I thought, because Robert Perry was reporting yesterday that Robert Perry is an investigative reporter who very often takes on stories that when they're first put out there seem like, oh, come on, that can't be. Like, you know, Robert Perry was one of the first guys to report that the Reagan campaign had cut a deal with the Ayatollahs in Iran to hold the hostages to screw Jimmy Carter in the election of 1980. He reported that Nixon, not back in the day, but as the evidence came out, that Nixon back in 68 blew up the, you know, John LBJ's successful negotiations with South and North Vietnam for a peace in 68 so that Hubert Humphrey would lose the election and Richard Nixon would win. He's reported extensively on the Kennedy assassination, stuff like that. So people sometimes think that Robert Perry is like, really pushing the edge, but he's usually right. And he's reporting that there are several news reports that the guy who pulled the trigger on the surface-to-air missile that took out the Malaysian airliner was a defector from the Ukrainian military. And there's growing suspicion among the rebels that he defected to the rebel cause in order to discredit them. And he took out the airliner to do that. Now, I read that yesterday. And I thought, well, this might be a stretch. And then I saw the headline this morning that the Prime Minister of Ukraine has resigned and that his parliament, his cabinet, is dissolved. And I thought, whoa, maybe there's something to it. And the story came out. Turns out there's apparently, at least on the surface, no relationship between the two. That this is more that the governing coalition has fallen apart. This guy can't pay his military. He's not able to govern in a functioning fashion. And Poroshenko, the president, is going to continue to hold power and call for a new election. But while this is happening, let's not forget, Ukraine is dropping bombs on cities in its own country, on the eastern border, on the border with Russia. And the people who are being bombed are the people who are using the surface-air missiles to try and take out the bombers. And they've brought down four or five of them so far. So this situation is a whole lot more complex than the simple jingoism or bumper stickers or conspiracy theories or accusations that we're hearing either, in my opinion, from the State Department, from the Russian government, or in particular from the Ukrainian government. You know, this most recent charge from the Ukrainian government that the Ukrainian fighter jets were shot down from Russian territory. I just don't believe it. The Ukrainian government is known for their hyperbole, and I don't think that Russia would be that stupid to actually intervene in a war from their own land. But we'll see how all this plays out, and I'll keep you up to date. The collapse of the coalition Thursday, as today, was the result of the withdrawal of two parties. UDAR, this is in the New York Times, David Herzenhorn reporting. UDAR, which is led by the former boxer Vitaly Klitschko, and the Svoboda Party, which is, they call it a nationalist party. I would call it a neo-Nazi party. The development followed weeks of negotiations, details of which were not immediately disclosed. So basically, the coalition, which included the Nazis, fell apart. They're fighting with each other. There have been fistfights in the Ukraine parliament the last 2 days in a row, and the thing has fallen apart. Not a good thing to happen when you're fighting a war, but we'll see where it all goes. In any case, it being anything goes summer, Michael in Denver. Hey, Michael, what's up?
wanting to call ADT, but I didn't know when we would be able to get a bill out to them.
I beg your pardon? Michael, you're on the air.
Hello.
Michael is listening to his, I guess, computer rather than telephone. So, Tom in Media, Pennsylvania. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Yeah. Hi, good afternoon. You know, I've been a union representative now retired for 23 years, and, you know, I hear about the demonization that people that they say don't work or can't find jobs or don't want to, by especially Paul Ryan. And I think a cause of this is the fact that, you know, the jobs are hard to find at decent wages. And what really frustrates me is that this immigration debate, neither side really seems to give a voice to the American worker,
right,
that is either unemployed or underemployed. And, you know, I volunteer for a drug and alcohol rehab hospital where they have an E-Verify system, and it's posted on their things where they use E-Verify, and they will not hire anybody that's here illegally. And I don't understand why there would be any battle or any type of controversy saying, look, you know, say starting with the construction industry, which to me is going to be the manufacturing industry, why we can't just require everybody to use the E-verification system in hiring, you know, take the money that we put on the border and pay for everybody to access that for free and say, look, if we can, there's 3 million people in the construction industry, just the construction industry right now that are here illegally. If we could eliminate that, we would have at least 1.5 million more Americans working in the construction industry. And nobody supports that. Everybody
right.
seems to be more concerned about people that are here illegally than they are American citizens that truly need good paying jobs.
Yeah. And historically, people came to this country without documentation to work temp jobs. They would come to this country and they would, you know, during the picking season, for example, or they would work for 6 months and then go back home. And in fact, I got a long letter about this a while ago. I have a cousin who is married to, or the daughter of one of my cousins, is a niece, I guess she would be, or second niece, whatever you call that. She is, you know, a Norwegian American, whatever, and she's married to a guy who is an undocumented immigrant from Mexico. And when ICE finally got wind of this, they'd already had a couple of kids. They fled to Mexico, and she's living in Mexico with her husband now, and, you know, keeps up with the family through Facebook and an email and stuff. And she was talking, and it's interesting the insights you get that, you know, there's so many families down in Mexico who have one person up here, and the original idea was go up, work for a year, come back, and live like a king for the rest of your life. And but because the job opportunities got so expanded when Reagan stopped enforcing the laws against people who are here without documentation working, against the employers. Reagan stopped putting employers in jail. No more white guys going to jail. That, you know, people have stayed 2 years and 3 years and 4 years and 5 years. And you take the jobs away, you're going to – and in fact, what we've seen over the last year is that there's actually been a negative – you know, the immigrant problem – immigration problem, in quotes – has vanished. There's more people leaving the country than coming to the country over the last couple of years, in large part because of the recession, because the jobs are just not there. But, you know, I'm with you, Tom. I wrote a chapter about this in my book, Rebooting the American Dream, that, you know, we need comprehensive immigration reform, and we need to do what pretty much every other country in the world does. I've worked in Australia, I've worked in the United Kingdom, and I've worked in Germany, and in all three cases, I had to get work permits from the government, from their governments, in order to do that. In the case of Australia, it took nearly a year to get the damn work permit. I mean, it was a huge – and this was just to come and give a speech and take a speaking fee, which they consider work. And it was nuts. Well, it wasn't nuts. I mean, what they're doing is they're saying, you know, if somebody's going to make money in Australia, it's going to be an Australian first. And if you can't – if you know, and I had to prove that no Australian had written the books that I had written and therefore couldn't speak on what I had spoken about. And it's – you know, that's how it used to be in the United States. I remember back in the 80s running a business in Atlanta where we wanted to hire a guy who was here without documentation because he spoke two languages that we needed, Japanese and Spanish, and he had a graphic arts design background, and I had to go down to the INS with him. I mean, he was fresh out of college. He was here on a student visa, which didn't allow him to work. And we tried to find an American who could do this job, and we couldn't. But in order to hire him, I had to go down to the INS office with him. We had to apply for a visa for him. It took 6 months. It was an expensive process. We had to hire a lawyer as an employer. You know, nowadays the employers just say, yeah, sure, come on in. You know, and there's no penalty. I was looking at penalties. I was looking at myself going to jail or my company having huge fines if I gave this guy a paycheck for work when he didn't have a work permit. He didn't have a visa. And go ahead.
That's exactly my point. That's exactly my point. I mean, why can't we go back to, you know, provide an e-verification system?
We can. E-verify is like the next step in that. It makes it so much easier.
Require it of these. Some are unscrupulous.
That's the law, actually. You know, Reagan stopped the 1986 immigration reform bill did not legalize hiring of people who are undocumented. Reagan simply stopped enforcing that part of the law. And no president since him has gone back to enforcing that part of the law. We have no problem in this country targeting brown people who are here from another country as the criminals. We say we have everybody, you know, there's this consensus across our media and across the political gentry that we have an immigration problem. We do not have an immigration problem in this country. We never have had an immigration problem. We have an illegal employer problem. It's rich white guys by and large, and they need to go to jail or at least have huge fines if they are conducting themselves in business illegally. I'm with you, Tom. Thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Which, as he points out correctly, you know, would open up more jobs for Americans. But that the big problem there is really our trade laws, not our immigration laws. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Arthur in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite. Hey, Arthur, what's on your mind?
Yeah, good afternoon, Tom. I met you in Portland at the UU conference a few years ago.
Oh, great. Well, thank you.
I just wanted to comment on the Ryan proposal. Having lived in Tennessee, Indiana, and Michigan, I am of the opinion that what basically Ryan is proposing is the Southern strategy of demanding block grants, using out numbers to say, yeah, we've got all these poor people, and then putting up barriers so that money can be diverted to various other places.
Right, right. They've already taken much of the middle class's money and diverted it to rich people through tax policy and trade policy. And now they want to take what little money there is available for genuinely poor people and divert that to and I guarantee you the Jerry Falwell heirs are going to be standing there with their hands out, you know, all these the not-for-profit religiously affiliated organizations saying, gimme, gimme, gimme. And then on top of this, they're going to create compliance with these rules. They're going to make compliance fairly difficult. So it's a further criminalization of poverty.
Absolutely. And if you look at how the Southern strategy has worked, they are getting tremendous returns on any dollars they're sending to the federal government using these kind of processes. And just one other comment. I believe that back in the days when dollars were sent directly to cities, the city of Detroit would not be in the mess that it's in. But the state of Michigan at some point basically stopped sending money to the city.
Right. Yeah, the state was intercepting that money, basically, and continues to. And
that's the strategy.
Yeah, and for people who don't understand what you're saying by Southern strategy, I believe what you're talking about is not so much Richard Nixon's let's get the racist vote in the South, but rather the economic strategy that is employed by the Republican Party and Republican governors in the Southern red states, where for every dollar they send to Washington, D.C., they make sure that they get back more than a dollar. So they're in some cases they're getting back $1.20, $1.30 for every dollar that they send to D.C. And the flip side of that is that the blue states, California, New York, Massachusetts, Vermont, the blue states, for every dollar they send to Washington, D.C., they get back 60, 70, 80, 90 cents because
right, we're subsidizing those.
We're subsidizing the Republicans.
People.
They are, you know, Reagan went off on the welfare queen, right? The biggest welfare queens in America are the Republicans, the red states. And they are doing it on the back of the American middle class, and it's wrong. It's just wrong, and they're doing it as intentional policy. This is how they keep. Go ahead.
I was just totally agreeing with you.
Yeah, and this is how they keep.
Closed.
This is how they keep people kind of dumb and happy, you know, keep voting Republican. You know, life is not going to be that terrible. We're going to get a, you know, $1.20 back for every dollar we send to D.C. And, you know, we'll spread it around. Some of it's going to go to our cronies and our buddies. But, you know, you're not going to starve, although you're not going to have health insurance. I think that this Medicaid expansion might be the straw that breaks the camel's back, or it might be the thing that the, you know, the rainstorm that causes people to look up and go, what's going on? Yeah, because people are starting to realize, and it's you're seeing this in North Carolina, you're seeing it in a number of states, people are starting to realize that they're being aggressively screwed. They are pawns in a political game that the Republicans are playing to try to destroy the Obama presidency and the Obama legacy. And this D.C. Circuit Court decision that people who are getting subsidies under Obamacare can't if they bought it on the exchange. This is another, you know, this is another hate. Note to poor people or note to low-income workers, the Republicans hate you kind of thing. Arthur, thanks for the call.
Tom Hartman here. Now you can appear on TV and radio. Want to talk to me face-to-face? And we'll play your video question on the air? Here's how you do it. Put your phone in video mode, hold it sideways, and record your selfie video question. Then email it to me at yourtakemytake@gmail.com.
We'll be doing those, your take, my take, at gmail.com. Your video questions, we'll be doing them tonight on the TV show, because it is Thursday, right?
Yeah.
It's Thursday, so it's your take, my take live. Michael in Denver. Hey, Michael, what's up? Are you listening now?
Yes, I am. Oh, I'm sorry.
You, that's quite all right. I understand how it goes.
I have a lovable but wild dog, and I have to run out into the yard sometimes to make sure that she's
okay. So what's up?
Well, I just wanted to call briefly and say when you opened the show, you mentioned about, you know, young people being idealistic, going out, you know, when, you know, and you're in college, they're about, you know, you see the world, you see issues, and you start to identify with, you know, things that are, that you believe are meaningful at that time in your life, like going back, in the day, well, I grew up during the Vietnam War, before that and everything, civil rights movement, just watched something very wonderful on, one of our public TV channels about the free speech movement, the Freedom Riders.
Yeah.
And stuff. And, you know, it was a very specific time for a lot of people. And I think it was Winston Churchill that said, you know, when you're young and idealistic, when you're in your 20s and all, you know, you tend to be a liberal, and I'll say air quotes, quote unquote, because I don't really know what a true liberal is or a true conservative is. And then as you get older, you become conservative. You know, you're working.
Churchill is
liabilities
is famous for that. Yeah.
But I think that he should have said, but when you get to your 60s, you start to swing the other way because you see a lot of bad people out there that are in there, maybe in their 30s and 40s, like Paul Ryan. They want to mess with your grandchildren's future.
Yeah.
They come along and they want to, you know, they want to change the paradigm, so to speak, to only benefit them and their cronies, and it's usually the people that are sitting up on top. So I just want.
Or they want to mess with your present. You know, they want to take the money that you've been paying into Social Security for 40 years in the workforce and basically steal it.
That's true, and they lie to our grandchildren by saying it's never going to be there.
Right.
It's not going to be there for you, and it's been really, it was a mistake what happened, and we should have, you know, done it, you know, the other way. Let Mr. Monopoly take care of you. And everybody can play Monopoly, and you know, everybody can be rich in this country, which is, you know, one of the biggest lies.
Yeah. No, in Monopoly, there's always one winner and everybody else loses.
One winner.
And that's what we have to keep reminding ourselves.
I wanted to say, Tom, you have a wonderful show. I've read your book, Crash 2016. Thanks for writing it, because it was definitely, you know, something that needed to be written today.
Well, thank you, Michael. That book has 2 years of work in it. I think it's a damn good book. Thank you for your kind comments on it. And thanks for calling in. Wayne in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening to KABQ. Hey, Wayne, you're a former public school teacher?
Yes, I taught public school for 13 years and charter school for 2 years, 15 total.
Mm-hmm.
13 years, a member of the FL-CIO, and 2 years not a union member, because if you teach at a charter school, you're not really in a union. They don't do that.
Was your charter school for-profit or not-for-profit?
Not-for-profit. It was state-chartered through the public school district. So,
uh-huh.
You know, part of my point that I want to make is I agree with you. Charter schools do have a purpose. They fill a gap that public schools sometimes don't with certain populations. But, you know, they do fight for state and federal money. So in the long run, charter schools do kind of cheapen the public schools because they take money from the public schools.
I agree.
And in the process, too.
I agree. Let me just stop you for a second.
Oh,
you,
sure.
You misunderstood me. The the Hunter School up in New Hampshire is not a charter school. It is a private school, and we deal with kids who mostly come in through Title I money, I think. We deal with kids who literally cannot make it in any school, who have failed in public schools, who have failed in charter schools, who have failed many times in private schools, kids who are, you know, the as Jesus would say, the least of the least. You know, for many of these kids, their only alternative is a locked environment. And we're way out in the middle of the, you know, the woods. We've got thousands of miles of forest around us. And it's not a locked environment. I mean, they could walk into town if they wanted to. But the net is we're filling a niche because there's you know, the state of New Hampshire and their infinite wisdom has not seen to do anything about this over the last 40 years. And instead, in fact, what they did recently is they built the John Sununu Child Center down in, I think, in Manchester. It's basically a giant, you know, warehouse for kids, which is just
sure.
a horrible thing.
Well, in the case of that school and most charter schools, we do have a lot of well-meaning people who are functioning schools serving the population that doesn't get served well by the average public school.
Right.
If there's one thing I can tell you, though, that this whole competition for money, making the schools follow the business model, which has not really worked well for healthcare, it's really starting to fail public schools too, and that's part of the reason why I've had to resign after 15 years of teaching.
Yeah, I agree.
I saw myself being a teacher forever, and we do have a Republican governor named Susana Martinez, who's very anti-public school. Her public ed representative, Hannah Scandera, as well, doesn't seem to value us and what we do. I can't think of another profession where you can go to college for 6 years and then get the right to go in and teach secondary education and start at $30,000 a year under the rules that we are facing today. It's just kind of disgusting.
Right. Had you done 6 years in an engineering school, you'd be starting at $70,000. Well, you know, if our H-1B visa program wasn't there.
But if we mention the salary, then we are anti-kid and we are an easy target to say, well, you're not in it for the right reason. So that's part of the issue, too. All I can tell you, and one more thought, is that in Albuquerque yesterday we did have a teacher fair because there are over 500 teachers short. They've asked anybody interested with a resume to show up and meet with a collection of 40 principals because, you know, there's just a desperate need now. And in the old days, you know, school districts weren't allowed to put teachers into the classroom with waivers or professional or provisional licenses. And I just wanted to say that I think they're going to really cross the line by putting a lot of non-licensed people into the classrooms.
No, that's not good. That's not good. Wayne, thanks for the heads up. Thanks for the comment. And thanks for the fine-tuning of my comments. I appreciate it. And thanks for listening to KABQ. We'll be right back.
Listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show. So please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's the second hour of our program. It's summer. There's some news out there. David Gregory is getting stabbed in the back by his colleagues. It's strange stuff going on at NBC. The Ukrainian Prime Minister has resigned. Parliament has dissolved. We'll see where that goes. And you know, I wonder if Victoria Nuland has come up with the name of the next Prime Minister. And will we hear that leaked tape? Anyway. And Paul Ryan has said he's going to solve poverty by, you know, making private corporations and churches richer. Bizarre stuff. But I wanted to talk... over the last couple of days, I dug into one of my books, Walking Your Blues Away. And, you know, it occurred to me this morning, actually, as I was thinking about the day, that over the years, I've written a lot of these books on the air, or they've come out of things that I say on the air. I bounce the ideas off people on the air as I'm writing the books. And there's a lot of good stuff that I've written down that I just don't revisit often enough. And so, and this isn't like just some, and I hope this doesn't sound like me thinks he'd out to protest too much, but this is not like some, gee, I'm going to try and sell more of my books. The economics, for those of you who are writers, you already know this. The economics of being an author are pretty grim. You've got a book that sells for $10 retail. It sells for $5 wholesale. The author gets maybe 10% of that, so that's 50 cents on a $10 book, and they get paid a year and a half later. So if I can stimulate the sale of 20 or 30 copies of one of my books, it ain't going to make me rich, right? I won't even buy dinner. But so this is not about that. This is really about just going back and sharing things with you that I've done the research on, I've seriously thought about, I've organized into a coherent fashion. And the book that I want to spend some time with over the next week is a book called Cracking the Code that I wrote back in, when was this thing published? 2007 is when it was published, so I must have written this in 2006. And in fact, this was a book that we wrote on the air. We actually, I went through long rants on the air, and we had a person who transcribed parts of them, and then I sat down with an editor, and we cleaned it up. And it's all about using neurolinguistic programming in politics. And what is communication and what is political communication, and how does that happen? What is the code that is used to make political communication effective? What is it that Frank Luntz knows and that we don't know? What is it that the Republicans do so effectively that Democrats don't do? And how can we communicate this in really simple language? Well, you know, back in, hopefully in my mind, in time for the 2008 elections, I wrote this book, Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision. And it's got a whole bunch of specific techniques in it that I want to share with you, so you don't have to buy the book. I'm going to go through it on the air with you for free. And we will even take these clips and put them on YouTube. So, first of all, Cracking the Code starts out with cracking the worldview code. And I think this is the most important part. You've heard me rant about Hobbes. I do it a lot. But it's important to understand the worldview code. If you're going to try to talk to a conservative, you have to understand how they're thinking, how they see the world. Or for that matter, if you're going to try and talk to a liberal, somebody who actually has conviction. And I start the first chapter out with the story of a friend of mine, and this is a true story, a friend of mine who was in the media, who had been a conservative, and a very public conservative for a number of years, and decided he was going to become a liberal. And when he did, the problem that he encountered, and we would particularly get into this in any kind of public, you know, he would write something and people would attack it, or he didn't know how to fall on particular issues. The examples that I give in the book is, and I remember these conversations, why are so many coal miners getting killed in mining accidents?
The conservative part of him was running off the old Milton Friedman, von Mises, von Hayek, Ayn Rand, Alan Greenspan theory, conservative theory, that businesses always want to behave in a way that is the optimal for their reputation, and therefore they would do everything they can to prevent coal miners from dying. But the reality is that businesses answer, you know, that's the conservative worldview, the liberal worldview from, you know, millennia of dealing with kings and kingdoms and nowadays modern corporations that are just kings and kingdoms revisited, is that corporations by law are sociopaths. They the first thing that they have to commit themselves to is profit. It's not to the people who work for them, it's profit. And so the people are secondary. And this is a consideration not just, you know, by the corporations, but it's a consideration at law. And then the other one that I remember he got tripped up with, this friend of mine, was, you know, why don't we teach music in schools anymore? And he was like, well, you know, it's like schools should be run like businesses, shouldn't they? And I'm like, no, that's not the liberal worldview. That's the conservative worldview. The liberal worldview is that education should be dynamic. It should be interactive. We should be teaching the Socratic method. We should be challenging children. We should be teaching them how to learn rather than, well, if we're going to teach them how to memorize, there's some simple ways to teach kids how to memorize things. Teach them how to memorize. Teach them how to learn. There's a difference between memorization and learning. And most importantly, teach them how to think, how to critically evaluate things. So it didn't work for this guy to suddenly become a liberal because he thought he was just switching teams, right? Gee, I used to be on the conservative team. I knew all their bumper stickers. Now I'm on the liberal team. I know all their bumper stickers. But he still was carrying this conservative worldview with him. And to this day, I'm not sure that he's fundamentally changed his conservative worldview, although he still talks about being a liberal. So, I talk about this and how it's important for us to understand where these stories came from, where these worldviews came from. What is the core of the liberal worldview? What is the core of the conservative worldview? How do we crack that code? And why is that important? Well, you know, obviously it's important for communication. And there's four stages in learning how to be a good communicator. And this is something that I'm going to be walking you through, too, is we start out unconsciously incompetent, right? We have a debate with somebody, an argument with somebody, try to make a point. It doesn't get across. I'm not successful in communicating this to somebody. I don't know why. I'm incompetent as a communicator, and I'm unconscious of it. Then we learn something. Then you learn something. Somebody says something. You read a book. You learn something that causes you to realize, you know, I'm actually an incompetent communicator. I'm not successfully communicating my message to people. They're not adopting my worldview. So I must be incompetent. So you become consciously incompetent. You go from unconsciously incompetent to consciously incompetent. Well, that's a really important step, because once you're conscious of your incompetence, then you start working on consciously becoming competent. So you start learning skills. And these are the skills that I lay out in the book Cracking the Code. Things like, you know, pacing and putting people in learning trances and matching and there's all these different techniques and phrases, and understanding story code and framing. And you do that intentionally for a while, becoming consciously competent, and then after a while it becomes second nature, and you are unconsciously competent. You just naturally are a brilliant communicator. And everyone can learn this. This is something that should be taught in our schools. And so I want to go through this over the course of the next, I don't know, well, you know, any kind of slow news day, if I can grab an hour, I'll do it. I'm making no commitments or predictions about how much we will, but I'm going to do it in this hour, at least the first half hour of this hour, and then I'll pick your phone calls up at the bottom of the hour with Cracking the Code. And I want to talk about the conservative worldview and liberal worldview, where they came from, how they came about, and what that means for conservatives and liberals today, particularly if you're debating with one.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So we're going through my old book, Cracking the Code. Now, it's not old. It's from 2007, but anyhow. Welcome back. I'm gonna continue my Cracking the Code rant when our commercial stations rejoin us in 5 minutes. So right now, Robert in Chapman, West Virginia, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. Hey, Robert, what's on your mind today?
Yes, sir. You were talking about the miners.
Yeah.
And I live in this area. I wish you would have a special segment on why miners are getting laid off. instead of a war on supposed war
on coal. Yeah, coal? I saw that Alison Lundgren Grimes. She's got a new ad where the guy is saying, "Mitch McConnell, we're losing our jobs here in Eastern Kentucky. Why?" You know, and then there's, you know, crickets, and yeah. Alison Lundgren Grimes says, "You know, I support this message." Why are miners getting laid off in coal country when coal country is producing more coal than it ever has before? Or is it not producing more coal?
When I talk to my local people, coal miners, I either get a left hook attempt or I get a blank stare by a Fox propaganda that they listen to, because I ask them, what's so special about your job when you did nothing to help the Reaganomics against your fellow workers in the factories? And they just don't have an answer.
In other words, these are people who want to be members of the coal miners' union. They want to be unionized miners, but they don't support
the union miners vote for Republicans sometimes.
That's my point.
I don't have an answer for that.
Right. But why are miners getting laid off? Is it because of automation?
They say the price is too low to have a profit.
So they're closing mines?
If you look into this and have a special segment. But anyway, sir, I would like to ask you, a while back you were talking about converting from a regular bank to a credit union.
Right.
I would like to do that, and I would like to know what to look out for.
Credit unions are very tightly regulated in the United States. They have to be chartered as a nonprofit. The people who put their money in the bank become stockholders, essentially, in the bank. Every dollar you have is a share in the credit union. They're cooperatives. Everybody who is in it owns it. Depositors elect the board of directors, who elects the president and chief executive officers. And all you have to do is pick which credit union you want. Now, some credit unions only serve specific populations. For example, here in D.C., there's the Federal Employees Credit Union. You got to be a federal employee to use that credit union. But most credit unions, and they're set up basically as a nonprofit bank by like the Federal Employees Union or a Federal Employees Association. So occasionally you'll find credit unions that have this fairly narrow focus. But most credit unions are just public institutions that compete with private community banks and with the big national banks. So I would say, you know, pull out your phone book or look on the internet for credit unions near you there in Chapmanville, West Virginia, and there's probably some nearby. And if not, there may be others who do business over the internet that you could start banking with. And all you do is open an account. It's just like opening a checking account.
Miles away.
Pardon?
The best ones are about 30 miles away in the capital, but that's all right.
Yeah, most of them these days allow you to bank with an app. You can mail in your deposits. You get checks. You mail your checks. You know, you can use a bank by mail or a bank on the internet. So, you know, other than having an ATM card, and they issue ATM cards that you can use in any ATM in the country. So there's really not a good reason not to move into a credit union. And your money, frankly, in my opinion, is a lot safer there than in any one of the big banks. Robert, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. So I'm going through this, cracking the conservative worldview code first. Let's look at the conservative worldview. You have to understand how conservatives view the world. And this was first articulated in the modern era by Thomas Hobbes in his book Leviathan. He was the tutor to King Charles II, who was in exile, essentially, after his father's murder. And Hobbes he wrote this book Leviathan. And one of the things that Hobbes was doing was he was basically lobbying to get his protege, this child that he was mentoring, back on the throne. And the argument that Hobbes made in the book was that we need to have kings, and we need to have noble kings, because the essential nature of people is evil. And if people were allowed to govern themselves, then we would be in what he referred to as the natural state of man, and that would be a bad thing. In fact, here, this is a verbatim quote, which is often quoted in books on conservative philosophy. You'll find pieces of it in Russell Kirk's The Conservative Mind and in writings of William F. Buckley and others. Thomas Hobbes in 1634 wrote, "In such condition,
right? Without people being ruled by the iron fist of church or king, the condition he's talking about, the natural state of man. In such condition, there is no place for industry, because the fruit thereof is uncertain, and consequently no culture of the earth, no navigation, nor use of the commodities that may be imported by sea, no commodious building, no instruments of moving and removing such things as require much force, no letters, no society, and which is worst of all, continual fear and danger of violent death, and the life of man solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. So that was a brilliant articulation of the conservative worldview. This is the natural state of man. And, you know, it stood throughout much of the 17th century, the 1600s. And his student, Charles II, actually ended up taking the throne. And after 3 years, I believe he died. Maybe he was overthrown. But his brother, James II, who took over the throne from him, James II was such a maniacal power freak that the Brits kicked him out. This is called the Glorious Revolution of 1688. And before they'd let William and Mary rule, Parliament passed the first real British Bill of Rights. So this is interesting. Well, during that time, one of England's greatest philosophers, John Locke, wrote his book, Two Treatises on Government. And he, by the way, had been the tutor to James II. And Locke wrote in his two treatises, and I quote, "Man being born, as has been proved," see, he didn't believe this notion that, you know, God ordains good people and makes everybody else inferior, and he didn't believe this notion that the natural state of man is to be horrible. He said, "Man being born, as has been proved, with a title to perfect freedom and an uncontrolled enjoyment of all the rights and privileges of the law of nature, equally with any other man or number of men in the world, hath by nature a power not only to preserve his property, that is, his life, liberty, and estate, against the injuries and attempts of other men." So, in other words, we can govern ourselves, and there is a right to life, liberty, and property. Now, Jefferson, in his autobiography, talked about how, you know, the increasing oppression of the British led to the Boston Tea Party, which led to the American Revolution. In fact, just before the Tea Party, he'd written a book called A Summary View of the Rights of British Americans, which basically was saying, here's how to be a good British citizen. But then after the Tea Party, it was like, okay, we've had enough of this. And so Jefferson in 1776, echoing Locke from 100 years earlier, roughly maybe 90 years earlier, Jefferson wrote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Now, so he changed property to happiness. And then he gets to the second part of that sentence, which is the most important part that is never quoted on Fox News or by conservatives. Here's the entire sentence in context. "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed." In other words, yeah, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and therefore we're creating this government. We are creating the United States of America. And that was a liberal statement. That was a progressive statement, that, as was Locke. Locke founded the modern, you know, with the Enlightenment in the 1670s and his two treatises on government. He created the modern liberal movement, and Thomas Jefferson was one of its most outspoken advocates, as were most of the other founders of this country, because we were a giant liberal experiment. In fact, George Washington called himself a liberal. He said, "I hope America shall ever be at the forefront of liberality." So what this comes down to is that one of the fundamental core differences between conservatives and liberals is that conservatives believe that, you know, when you hear them talk about the free market's going to solve all our problems, you know, the Paul Ryan, you know, if you just turn everything over to the free market, everything will be wonderful. They believe that the marketplace should replace government. That they'd say, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that to
to paraphrase Jefferson, they say to secure these rights, markets are instituted among men. Right? That's not what Jefferson said. So conservatives think that amoral institutions like corporations or churches are morally superior to evil humans, whereas liberals believe that amoral institutions like corporations or churches or even government are inferior to humans. And this is a really profound thing. I mean, you read the preamble to the Constitution of the United States, it basically says this. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. It doesn't then follow with, do create a free market. It says, do ordain and establish this Constitution for our new government, for the United States of America. So there's your fundamental difference. That's the first code you've got to
crack. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
From the first chapter of Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision. We'll pick up your calls after the break. We'll get back to Anything Goes Summer. Okay, case in point. This is the lead graphic over on democraticunderground.com right now, is that they recently did a survey and they asked people, do you think you could live on the minimum wage? And they asked both Democrats and Republicans, self-proclaimed. And both groups, the majority of both groups said, no way I could live on the minimum wage. 80% of Democrats, 69% of Republicans said, yeah, not a chance. So they said, then, do you think that the minimum wage should be raised? Do you want your politicians to raise the minimum wage? Now, keep in mind this difference in worldview between conservatives and liberals. Conservatives think that, you know, government is somehow, because it's answerable to the people, it's somehow a corrupt institution, whereas institutions that are not answerable to the people, that are owned by basically kings, noble people, corporations, and the free market that's associated with them, that is the ultimate good. This is the conservative worldview. In the liberal worldview, it's we created government to make a better life for ourselves. This is why conservatives are constantly trying to say, you know, government is the source of your problems. It's not the solution. That was Ronald Reagan's famous quote, or I just paraphrased it. I got it backwards, but, you know, you get the point. Or I said it in the wrong order. Whereas liberals are, I think, in some ways correctly. It's a slur from the Republicans, but to say big government liberal, yeah, we want a government that's big enough to be effective, to do the job it's supposed to do. The government we have right now is obviously not doing that. It's way too big in some areas, like the military, but it's not anywhere near big enough in other areas. We're not doing the best we can to educate our kids. There are $1 trillion in debt as a consequence of that. We're not doing the best we can to make sure that there's not poverty in our country. We're not doing the best we can to make sure that people have access to health insurance, to health care. So anyhow, back to this survey. 80% and 69% respectively of Democrats and Republicans say, I could not live on the minimum wage. So then you say, so should the government intervene? If you can't live on the minimum wage, should it make it that, you know, obviously you don't think anybody can live on the minimum wage. So should the government raise the minimum wage to the point where people can live on it? Well, three-quarters of Democrats say yes, as you might expect. 75% of Democrats said, yeah, of course the government should raise the minimum wage. I couldn't live on it. Why? Nobody else could. Republicans? These are Republican voters, Republicans who are putting people like Paul Ryan in power. Republicans say no. The majority of Republicans say no, the government should not raise the minimum wage. I do not want my elected representative to raise the minimum wage, even though I could not live on it. Screw those people. Only 37% of Republicans say yes, raise the minimum wage, about a third, whereas three-quarters of Democrats do. This is this profound and clear difference in worldview, which is really important stuff to understand. So, anyhow, that said, let's get your phone calls in here. Steve in Landisville, Pennsylvania. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. First time caller.
Well, thank you. And thanks for listening to SiriusXM.
Sure. Thanks. I want to explain to people now. I want everybody to, I want to be clear on this. The way you're raised
and the religious views you have in your upbringing are what changes everything. And the way you see whether you're a liberal or you're conservative, it's pretty much in your upbringing. But people need to realize what happened back in the 80s when we elected basically Reagan. Let's see what Reagan was notorious for. He was a serial tax raiser. He raised taxes 11 times. He changed the tax code and put the burden of the taxes on the middle class and the poor. He also gave amnesty to 3,000 undocumented workers. We also had the Iran-Contra scandal. He also funded and trained the Mujahideen freedom fighters, which also included Osama bin Laden. It's just Reagan really changed the burden and placed most of it on the middle class and the poor. He basically changed the way how the Republicans think. The Republican Party used to be the party of the people. You know, we had people like Lincoln and all the way they're thinking, and then all of a sudden they switched and moved to the corporations, and now the Democrats are more the party of the people.
Yeah.
But at this point, until conservatives realize that their almighty king, Reagan, was the source of the problem, I mean, we're never going to get anywhere. Let's be real. I mean, I have no affiliation to any political party. I don't even consider myself an independent, but I will consider myself a fiscal conservative. You know, Reagan automatically put so much money into fighting the Russians and communism when he was even told by his own people that the Russian economic system and military power was going to fail,
right?
Because it just had no money.
Right.
So we spent more money and everybody got the sphere of communism. They tried to build everything up, and then, you know, just Reagan just basically giving everything to the businesses, deregulating. And I experienced it firsthand. I was young at the time. I was only 11 or 12 years old, but I watched my parents lose two jobs when he basically passed regulation, you know, deregulating the unions, allowing the air traffic controllers, you know, basically to let people walk over the picket line. I watched my parents struggle to pay the mortgage, to put food on the table. I've seen it firsthand. So you could probably say I'm more liberal, but I don't like to consider myself a liberal or a conservative. I like to be more considered an American first.
Yeah, I understand that. And I think that's very well said. There's a great list over at topplebush.com/blamereagan.shtml. And it's titled Blame Everything on Ronald Reagan. And they go through like 8 pages of things that in the modern era that you can blame on Reagan. But see, Reagan was really just, he was the moment when they seized power. But it was set into place in 1971 and 72. There's 2 chapters in my book, The Crash of 2016, my newest book, about this, about who Lewis Powell was, why he wrote the memo to Eugene Sindor, his next-door neighbor and the head of the Chamber of Commerce, saying, we've got to get political, we've got to start the Heritage Foundation, we've got to start the Federalist Society, we've got to start the Cato Institute, we've got to do all this. I mean, he didn't name them by name, but he said, we've got to start putting our people in the colleges so they start teaching our form of economics and history. We've got to reinvent history. We've got to seize power. We need a Supreme Court that will say that rich people have more say in the political arena than average working people. That was in 71. He wrote this memo. In 72, Richard Nixon put him on the Supreme Court. And in 76, Powell wrote the majority decision in a case called Buckley versus Vallejo, where for the first time in the history of our republic, the Supreme Court said, I know that ever since the George Washington administration, the spending of money has been considered a behavior which can be regulated, whether it's spending money to buy a candy bar, whether it's spending money to hire a hitman, or whether it's spending money to buy a full-page ad for or against a politician in the New York Times or a commercial on television. But we are now saying, we are inventing this doctrine that the First Amendment, when it says Congress shall pass no law limiting freedom of speech, that it actually meant money. Congress shall pass no law limiting freedom of money. And they discovered money in the First Amendment in 1976 in that case, Buckley versus Vallejo. And then a year later, in a case called First National Bank versus Bilotti, there was a law in Massachusetts that said that corporations could not spend money on political activity unless it directly affected the corporation. And the First National Bank in Boston had been funding either a campaign or a candidate who was, as I recall, all about abortion, which has got nothing to do with banking. And so Frank Bellotti, the Attorney General of Massachusetts, sued them. It went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, again, Lewis Powell, said this is a corporation. As a corporation, it has rights under the 14th Amendment. And again, read the 14th Amendment. You will not find that. But as a corporation with rights under the 14th Amendment to equal protection under the law, it has also equal protection under the First Amendment doctrine that we just invented, that money is in the First Amendment. And so corporations can spend money on politics. And this began, this set the stage for the rich people to come in and basically buy the election of 1980 and put Ronald Reagan into office. And then Reagan set the stage for what ultimately became Citizens United. And now you've got a situation where people like Shelley Adelson are literally sitting around saying, come kiss my ring. I will decide who's going to be the next Republican candidate for president of the United States. And it's not quite as bad. It's not anywhere near as bad, frankly, on the Democratic side, but it's still pretty bad on the Democratic side. And it's all because of the Supreme Court. So so we can't just entirely blame Reagan on it, but you're right. Reagan was when this worldview seized the power of the executive branch. And by that time, they already had maybe a quarter of Congress. And by the time Reagan was done, they had the majority of Congress. And they've had it ever since. We have been, you know, Reagan turned back the FDR revolution and destroyed the rights of workers, working people in this country, championed the right, in quotes, the rights of billionaires and transnational corporations. And 33 years of Reaganomics has destroyed the American middle class. And there is a coherent philosophy behind it, which says that you can't trust the average person. John Adams used to refer to average working people as the rabble. And, you know, it didn't want people who didn't own property to be able to vote. Thomas Jefferson, this was the Revolution of 1800, the next book that I've got coming out, actually, this fall. Thomas Jefferson said, no, the rabble are the people. We need the, you know, the people themselves need to be making decisions about government. This is why we have the House of Representatives elected every 2 years, so they're answerable to the people. And so, anyhow, Steve, I'm ranting, but thank you for bringing up Reagan. I appreciate it. It's good to hear from you. Thanks for listening to SiriusXM. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the end.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
You know, I shouldn't apologize for ranting. It's my job. Anyhow, we'll be back. Bob Ney with Talk Radio News Service will be here with us in 5 minutes. Welcome back. Renee in Judah, Wisconsin, watching Free Speech TV. You are on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Is it Renee or Rennie?
Renee,
okay.
Tom, I was just wondering if you could go into a little bit more about what Paul Ryan's new plan is supposed to be, considering as states already get block grants anyway through TANF, and they get to decide right. How they're going to use the money, when they're going to use the money, who the money's going to go to. So is this going to just take those TANF payments and then disperse them to religious or nonprofits?
No, it puts the whole thing on steroids. He's got there's a good summary of this over at Daily Kos, which is what I'm reading from. Laura Clausen wrote it. She says that he's suggesting to consolidate 11 federal anti-poverty programs into one block that they will then just give the money to the states and say, you can do whatever you want. You don't have to do these 11 things. And that there is a what they call a contract that poor people are going to have to sign with the government. And this contract outlines specific and measurable benchmarks for the poor person's success, a timeline for meeting these benchmarks, sanctions for breaking the terms of the contract, incentives for exceeding the terms of the contract, and time limits for remaining on cash assistance. In other words, there's only a certain amount of time that you can get money from the government. And so basically what he's saying is we are going to treat poor people the same way that we treat contractor corporations with the government. You've got to tell us what you're going to do. You've got to do it. If you fail to do it, you're going to get penalized. And if you continue to fail to do it, we're going to cut you off. And that's, frankly, in my opinion, not how you should deal with human beings.
Well, so then what is so different than what we already have in place for, like, TANF and
Right.
Some cash assistance are already time limited anyway, and
you're right.
States can, you know, arbitrarily cut back that time limit.
That's right. What this will do is it will give states the ability. I mean, you know, the Clinton era welfare reforms did a lot of damage to the Great Society, to the programs that Lyndon Johnson put into place, and even some of the programs that went back to the New Deal. And it also, the Clinton era welfare reforms also moved a lot of stuff from the federal government to the state level, where some states implement these things well and other states implement them very poorly. And what Paul Ryan would do is just double down on that, basically. Take more of these federal programs, do away with all of their rules, all of their requirements, all of their goals, you know, all the specific details of them, and simply say, okay, here's a block of money. We're going to give this to the states. The states can decide how to accomplish their anti-poverty goals, which sounds good. You know, it sounds 10th Amendment-ish, you know, state rights-ish. But the reality is that history shows us that particularly with states that have large minority populations, their record on using federal money to help the poor is pretty grim. And also, once you've created block grants and, you know, that aren't tied to federal standards, it's really easy to say, well, you know, we gave you $5 billion last year. This year we can only afford to give you four. And then next year we can only afford to give you three. Pretty soon there's nothing. And good luck. And, you know, so that's the Paul Ryan budget, in my mind, is just more magical thinking. It's more Ayn Rand magical thinking. Renee, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Let's check in with Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by Goats for the Old, goat.com and free-don.org. Congressman, and I should say, Congressman Ney is also the author of the brilliant book, Sideswiped. You know, and what's the subtitle for that, Bob?
Sideswiped, Lessons Learned Courtesy of the Hitmen of Capitol Hill.
It's brilliant. Lessons Learned Courtesy of the Hitmen. And the hitmen, of course, being the politicians in the House.
Boehner, Rove, et al.
Yeah, there you go. So what's going on in the world today, Bob?
Well, in the world, we have, through the FAA, we have lifted the Israel flight ban. We had a 24-hour ban. And I just wanted to note something on this because it's a quote, which is not newsworthy, but worthy of, I think, mentioning. Senator Ted Cruz actually attempted to blame the FAA flight ban Israel because a plane was diverted, you know, with Americans on board to Paris due to some rockets. Senator Ted Cruz actually said that the president had this flight ban and it was more or less to have an economic war on Israel.
Right.
And I just actually mentioned that because it would be amazing, you know, with a quote like that it's not even passed the smell test, but the guy wants to run for president. So I just thought it was an amazing stretch.
Well, what's even more amazing is that Fox News picked it up and ran with it as if it was a serious charge.
Well, that's the other reason I mentioned it. It's not, as I said in the beginning, it's not worth the news, but it is worth mentioning it because they actually did print it. And I just found it incredible to blame the FAA when a plane was actually diverted,
right,
you know, over to Paris from Tel Aviv. So,
right, because there were rockets in the area.
Flights are proceeding as normal, although some airlines may not, you know, fly for a while, depending on the amount of problems that are over there.
I think this speaks to the lack of ethics, perhaps lack of self-control, and lack of integrity on the part of Ted Cruz, and to his utter belief. I mean, you know, I don't know if you've seen the videotapes of his father asserting that, you know, the King of the Seven Mountains speeches, that Ted Cruz is to be the new king of the world. He's been ordained the new king, and he's basically John the Baptist. He's the guy who's going to take power, political power, and then pave the way for the return of Jesus Christ. And
it will take an act of the Lord to make him president of the United States.
I think so, too, but he doesn't think so. Or he thinks that the Lord will actually intervene in electoral politics, something that, by the way, Mitt Romney actually believed.
It was just amazing. I mean, just that kind of quote to come out. So, you know, they have lifted the flight ban and had nothing to do with economic boycott of Israel in the first place.
Yep.
I did want to, you know, of course, we have so many things going on around the world. But I did want to note the bill that did pass today, and it was 97-3, and that was by Senator John Walsh of Montana, Democratic member, and Debbie Stabenow, a Democratic member of Michigan. And it's a bill that would deal with the long problem that Senator Sanders has complained about for over a decade, and that is the tax write-off for relocating costs and an additional 20% tax credit. And these are jobs, basically, of which they say we've lost 2.4 million that have been outsourced over the last 10 years.
Right. Let me restate that, if I may. Mm-hmm. Right now, if you are a company and you have a factory in America and you want to move that factory to China, you get a tax break for doing that.
That's
and
right.
If you want to bring that company back to the United States, you get no tax break. And what this and by the way, this is very similar to legislation that Nancy Pelosi passed in the first year of the Obama administration, and that was filibustered by Republicans in the House, you will recall. And so what this legislation says is no more tax break for moving jobs overseas, and we'll give you a 20% tax credit for bringing those jobs back home. Am I saying that right, Bob?
Oh, yes. You said it much better than I did, much clearer. It's a very pro worker amendment. It doesn't give you a break.
So here's the question. John Boehner will not even allow an extension of long-term unemployment benefits, even though 3 million people are watching their families dissolve, homelessness, divorce, you know, all kinds of problems as they've been cut off since Christmas. He won't even allow a vote on extending long-term unemployment benefits. And we, the people, working people, pay into the unemployment fund. Why do you think he's going to allow a vote on this piece of legislation that would bring our jobs back from overseas when it's not, you know, this arguably would not be in the best interest of big corporations that make everything overseas?
Well, you know, I reported on all the stations I've been doing today just a prediction that this will not even see even near light of day, because some of the largest of the large in utilizing this against American jobs, I promise you, will make sure that the John Boehner exercises his power, that he will not even have this go to any form of a process.
Right. So there will be no vote on this. It will die in the House of Representatives because Walmart doesn't want it and Apple doesn't want it and any of these other companies that are making stuff in China or Vietnam or wherever, they don't want it.
And I thought it was just an excellent bill. And Mitch McConnell, the Republican minority leader, criticized, again, voted for the bill. It was had overwhelming votes. But they criticized the fact that, well, the Democratic side really should work with us. This bill is just kind of a sham, and they should work with us to do some real things to spurn jobs for, you know, international growth, et cetera.
In other words, we should cut taxes for rich people even more.
Yeah, but they voted for the bill.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't dislike it enough to not vote for it.
Well, I think they finally got shamed into it. You know, it's like people are, you know, there's an election coming. People are paying attention. When they filibustered it back in 2009, I think it was,
yes.
Nobody was paying attention. The election was over. And everybody thought, hey, Obama's president, everything's going to get wonderful.
Yes, and again, I just wanted to point out, you know, that it is something that Senator Sanders just had really had a lot of support for in his House days,
mm-hmm.
and just could not get anybody to actually, you know, get it to the vote.
That's great. So what else is up? We got about a minute left, Bob.
Okay. One other thing is just for down the road, the president is looking at executive orders, and I know John Boehner today is, speaking of the speaker, is trying to move the pending lawsuit issue through the committee. But the president is looking at executive orders to develop privacy guidelines for commercial drones operating in the U.S. airspace. So much of this issue has come to the forefront. The White House is going to begin that process to see, you know, what about drones? What do they do? If they're private drones, do they collect data? And I think it'll be an important measure that the White House will take some time on to just protect some privacy rights.
Interesting. It'll be interesting to see what comes out of that because, you know, the collection of data has become an industry, not only at the NSA, but also at, you know, Google and whatnot. So
that's right.
Yeah. Congressman Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped. The subtitle, Bob?
Is Lessons Learned Courtesy of Hitman of Capitol Hill.
There you go. And with the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends. Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters: Identity Guard, Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And Mike Papantonio, host of Ring of Fire Radio, America's attorney. RingofFireRadio.com is on the line with us. Hey, Pap, how you doing today?
Tom, how are you?
Just fine, thank you. I understand that you are noticing, shall we say, what your governor is up to.
Well, he's up to something just about every other day. His latest things is he was going to have a fundraiser with a guy named James Batmassian, who just days before the fundraiser was supposed to take place, where they're going to charge $10,000 a plate and then $3,000 to be able to talk to him personally, they found out, well, they knew going into it that he was a repetitive felon. Had actually spent time in the pokey, the federal pokey, for fraud. And
isn't that true of Rick Scott too? I mean, he didn't go to jail, but wasn't he a felon
he
CEO?
Been. Well, he should have been. I mean, frankly, this is a guy who stole somewhere between $1 billion and $2 billion from Medicaid and Medicare. Said he didn't know anything about it. When they started asking him questions, a friend of mine actually had the opportunity to ask him questions about his involvement. And he 75 times took the Fifth Amendment and said, gee whiz, I can't answer those questions because I might be criminally prosecuted.
Whoa.
But this new story about Geo, this is an incredible story. He's down here in South Florida, and in order to understand the importance of this story, it's critical to recognize who Geo is and what their sorry history actually looks like. The U.S. Justice Department, Tom, for example, determined that Rick Scott's sweetheart, number one contributor, Geo, had wreaked havoc on juvenile prisoners that it had locked up in its prison system. At just one of the facilities, for example, where the U.S. Justice Department did one of their investigations in Mississippi, Geo had hardened gangbanger gang members acting as guards overseeing hundreds of incarcerated juveniles. The Justice Department determined that sexual exploitation of those juveniles was the worst than they'd ever seen anywhere in the nation. Not my words, that's the U.S. Justice Department. A federal judge called the GEO operation inhumane cesspool. That's a conservative Republican federal judge that said that. But that's okay with Rick Scott. Rick Scott's parading this company down here with his arms around the CEO of the company. And the reason he has his arms around the CEO is because the CEO gave him $20,000 in personal money to redecorate his house. So Rick
really?
Scott yes, $20,000 to put into the part of the governor's mansion because his wife, it just wasn't up to her standards. But Rick Scott embraces this organization as one of the GOP gang that he's so proud of. And Tom, I have to tell you, a Mad Max caliber of violence and chaos is the brand that defines GEO. The GEO organization has proven to be so second rate as a private prison organization. They pinch pennies, they understaff. In one situation, they left a juvenile inmate with permanent brain damage because the person guarding that juvenile allowed other juveniles to come in and stomp on his head and cut him with a knife till he has permanent brain damage. Stabbings and near-death beatings have taken place when untrained, sadistic guards have actually encouraged juveniles to fight one another as a sport. But Rick Scott is just fine having a $10,000 per plate fundraiser with these trolls, these horrible characters at GEO. Scott's been the governor's shield for GEO for years now. He's helped GEO earn multi-millions of dollars. They control all the private prisons down here. And he's actually described these thugs as bold, innovative, cost-saving private prison types who, in his words, are an example of the American dream. It's really more like the American nightmare. But that is our corrupt governor who actually could still win this election because he has so damn much money. And he's outnumbering the dollars, Charlie, like, 50 to 1.
Yeah, and according to the Vallejo decision back in 76, he can spend all the money he wants, as long as it's
his
money. Yes,
personal money and other.
Uh-huh. Yeah, which is mind-boggling. Another gift to us from Lewis Paul. I understand that GEO Group, in many cases, particularly with, I read this in the context of a story, and I think it might have been CCA, the other big prison company, Correction Corporations of America, that they were running a bunch of the private prisons down on the border where they're holding detainees, and they have a contract with the government that requires the government to provide them 90% capacity or pay
That's
for
right.
it anyway. Does GEO Group
right.
do that in Florida too?
Well, yeah, GEO Group has got this governor. The new GEO pitch is this. The new GEO pitch to this governor is, Governor, business is good. Our beds are full. But we're now going to need more tax write-offs. We're going to need more tax subsidies from the government because we need to increase our profit margin. We only made $90 million last year with these certain facilities. We need to make more money. So you have the governor caving into that. And of course you have GEO who gave, the numbers are staggering what they've given to Republicans in this state. But GEO has become like the Republican sugar daddy down here in Florida. The media has barely reported this story. People are in the streets. They're objecting to what's going on in front of Scott. You know, but you know what? This story that I just gave you, go online and try to find any newspaper or any media telling this story. They aren't telling the story at all. All I had to do is have our producers do a search on the U.S. Justice Department, and they came up with these deplorable stories where we have a governor with his arms around these private.
So you found this information through searching court records rather than reading newspaper accounts that the media in Florida are as afraid of Rick Scott as anybody else? Is that the deal? Or in the bag with
you
him?
You can find it. You can find it even easier than that. You can find it by just going and Googling the relationship between GEO and Scott. And you will see that from the day Scott got into power, he started selling the idea that we need to privatize prisons. That was one of the very first things he did. Huh. And then go look at the money that comes to Rick Scott. Now, this is a guy who started out with almost $80 million of his own money in the first governor's race. He has so much money now that he literally has bought up all of the available ad time on most of the mainstream media in the state of Florida. So
Charlie Crist can't compete with him because he can't even buy advertising time.
Well, that's right. But no matter how awful this character is, and he's an awful character, no matter how awful he is, I have to tell you, he could very well win this election in Florida the same way he did last time. And low turnout by the Democrats, big money by the Republicans. The Republicans in Florida have built a much better ground game than the Democrats have. Understand, Obama only won by about 75,000 votes in this state.
Wow.
75,000 votes. And had Rick Scott pulled off the purges that he, 180,000 people to be purged from the records, Obama would have lost this election. Wow. So that's the state of politics in Florida. I don't urge you to move here. If you're listening to this broadcast, this is not the place to live these days. The politics are so upside down.
That's astounding. And nobody is calling him out on it. We had Charlie Crist on the program. He sat right here in the studio, and he just said, you know, this guy was a criminal. I mean, he ran a criminal enterprise when he was a CEO. I'm paraphrasing, I'm sure, but. I was stunned to hear him say that blunt.
Well, the number, the documents are overwhelming. I mean, look, He had between $1 billion and $2 billion. It's not clear because it went on for so long. While he was CEO of the company, was moving away from Medicaid, Medicare, government entities of all kinds. That we find out he was basically stealing from the government. The government gave him a free pass.
And then he becomes governor. Then he becomes the government.
Yeah.
And he gives it to his buddies in the GEO Group. Mike Papantonio, you always have the most well-researched and brilliant analysis. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And that's ringoffireradio.com for America's attorney, Mike Papantonio. And check out their weekend show also on TV, on Free Speech TV. And welcome back. Pap, you still with us?
I am, Tom.
Hey, great. So this weekend, this Sunday, Ring of Fire TV here on Free Speech TV. What's coming up?
Well, we have Farron Cousins, who's one of our key producers here with the Ring of Fire operation. He hosted the program. He's going to host the program. And he's going to have Mike Berg with him. They're going to talk about the Citigroup fraud settlement and how it is absolutely meaningless, how you may as well just have slapped him on the wrist and said, go home for your thievery and fraud. We're going to have David Haynes that's going to give us the latest details on the GM disaster, where they knew for years and years that their product had the potential to kill people and what actually did kill people. And then they hired a woman CEO to try to soften the blow because she looked like less of a criminal. So they put her up in front of Congress, and now we find her lying in front of Congress. Howard Nations is going to talk about the extremist group, that are coming out of the Bundy Ranch experience. They're splintering off in all different kinds of ways. Matthew Edding is going to explain how private equity is being looted in America by Wall Street in ways that the media has not even mentioned to us. But I think the most important thing about the program is what we try to do I think progressive media is much better about launching new people into this discussion. And Farron Cousins is a hugely talented person working for us and has for years, along with Scott Milliken, Damien, and Gary. We try to put them in the middle of these programs and help them grow so they can carry on the message long after, hopefully after you and I are no longer on TV and radio.
Yeah, these guys are smart.
They're very
smart.
You've
got some really good people working with you.
You have the same thing. I've worked with your people. It's remarkable. But we do, and I know you do the same thing, is try to empower them have them understand they have to carry on.
Yeah.
And so that's what we're trying to do with Free Speech TV more and more.
That's great. That's great that you're doing that. What are you up to these days, Pat? What's ringing your bells?
Yeah, I just finished a big case, and it was against a company that had been involved with it was Pradaxa. And we were able to finish that case up. We're now looking at a company called Xarelto, which is a product that's causing people to bleed to death. It's a product much like Pradaxa, but the Xarelto product may even be worse. The Xarelto product, doctors are giving it to patients and saying, gee whiz, you're having atrial fib, take this. The problem is, Tom, they're stubbing their toe, they're falling down, hitting their head, and they're bleeding to death. And then the doctors are calling the manufacturers and saying, how do we stop this bleeding? And the company says, well, we don't really have an antidote for it. The product's called Xarelto. Well, I strongly recommend people to stay away from it. You would do just as well with other products that are out there that have been out there much, much longer.
So if you're taking aspirin or if you're taking warfarin, there are ways to clot,
yes,
stop the bleeding.
Yes. Warfarin will clot almost immediately. Aspirin, of course, is not a problem at all. But you see, what happens in the industry, Tom, is they invent new products that are completely unnecessary.
I
tell people never take a new product that's on the market unless it's been out there 10 years.
Right.
Xarelto is a great example of it. This was a get-rich-quick cash cow product that we see emerging almost every week.
Amazing. By the way, Pap, a woman named Judy yesterday called and said that she had gotten a settlement from a drug company for hormone replacement therapy because of watching or listening to your program, something that you said, and she wanted me to pass along her thanks to you. You changed her life. Pap, thanks a lot for the great work you're doing.
Appreciate it.
Ringoffireradio.com. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, isn't this special? The October recess is coming up. You know, the whenever the Republicans control Congress, they always work about half the year, and work is a word that can be defined in a variety of ways. nowadays, about half the year, they're maybe even a little less than half the year, they're naming post offices after Ronald Reagan. I thought it was amazing that Bob Ney came on our program in the last hour and talked about how with over 90% of the Senate, over 90 votes in the Senate, they passed a bill that would take away the tax benefits that companies get from steel companies to computer companies that they get when they move factories offshore, and would give those companies a 20% tax credit if they brought their factories back to the United States. This passed the Senate today. And I said to Bob, who was a member of the House of Representatives, who knows John Boehner personally, knows all these guys. Bob was a Republican member of the House of Representatives. He was the guy that when the Ayatollah wanted to, when Iran wanted to work out a deal with the United States and have peace with America, because Bob speaks Farsi, which is the language they speak in Iran. He's the only member of Congress who speaks Farsi. They wrote a letter and delivered it to Bob through their ambassador in the Swiss embassy, asking Bob to take it to George W. Bush. Bob took it to the Bush people, and within a few months, Bob was in jail. It's an amazing story. It's in his book, Sideswiped. But anyhow, I was just amazed to hear him say, you know, I said, okay, this bill passes overwhelmingly in the Senate, Democrats and Republicans, even Mitch McConnell voted for it. Will John Boehner bring it up for a vote? And he said, no, not going to see the light of day. Why? Well, John Boehner wasn't in the room, but Paul Ryan was, and Kevin McCarthy was, and Eric Cantor was, on January 20th, 2009, when the caucus room conspiracy was hatched. And one of the people in that room was a guy, let me remind you, was a guy named Pete Sessions. He's a congressman from Texas. And after this four-hour-long meeting, the night that Obama and his wife were out dancing with Ellen Ratner and me, and their other 300 best friends, over at Union Station. This is January 20th, 2009, the night that Obama was inaugurated. This four-hour meeting, one of the other guys in that room was Pete Sessions, Congressman Pete Sessions. And Pete Sessions, in 2009, in an interview with National Journal, which I discovered last week, National Journal has now removed from the Internet. But it lives on in a great blog post by Keep 'Em Honest, over the Daily Kos from June 8th, 2012, titled Eric Cantor, Paul Ryan, and Kevin McCarthy Plot to Sabotage U.S. Economy with Frank Luntz. Here's what Congressman Sessions had to say to National Journal in March, a couple months later, about, you know, basically the plan that they had hatched. Congressman Sessions says, Taliban insurgency. We understand perhaps a little bit more because of the Taliban. Insurgency is the way they went about systematically understanding how to disrupt and change a person's entire process. And these Taliban are an example of how you go about to change a person from their messaging to their operations to their frontline message. And we need to understand that insurgency may be required when dealing with the other side. If the Democrats do not give us those options or opportunities that we want, then we will become insurgency. I think insurgency is a mindset and an attitude that we're going to have to search for and find ways to get our message out and be prepared to see things for what they are rather than trying to do something about them. Rather than doing something about them? Yeah, shut down everything. Crash the government so that everybody will blame it on Obama. This has been the Republican strategy since the night the president was inaugurated. So now Congress is getting ready to take this huge vacation, the August recess, right? Basically, the whole month of August, they just go. And Pete Sessions came before the cameras this morning and said, here's what's important. It's not voting on long-term unemployment, even though that's sitting in the House of Representatives, and John Boehner could bring it to a vote, and it would pass, and 3 million Americans would get their long-term unemployment benefits checks and be able to avoid losing their homes or their marriage or whatever. No, it's not that. It's not, some kind of comprehensive immigration reform, which passed the Senate and went to the House, and John Boehner is refusing to bring to a vote. It's not this new bring your factory home bill, and we're not going to subsidize you when you take factories overseas bill. Not that. No, what is it that Pete Sessions wants the House of Representatives to vote on before the August recess? Suing Obama. Here's what Pete Sessions said to reporters. He's the chairman of the House Rules Committee. He said, quote, speaking of President Obama's executive actions and executive orders, he said, quote, it was not the way our system of government was designed to work. Laws are not a mere list of suggestions that a president can pick and choose. Actually, Congressman Sessions, they are. The Constitution and most laws gives the executive branch a lot of latitude in how they execute the law. They have to faithfully execute the law, but that's up to the discretion of the president. And if you don't like the way he's doing it, pass a law cutting off the funding to him, or pass a law that specifically mandates the way that he has to execute that law. If you don't like the fact that the president has said, okay, we're going to delay for a year the employer mandate in Obamacare, the same way that George W. Bush did by executive order with Medicaid Part D, he delayed the implementation of several pieces of that. Not a single Republican peeped about that. But they're all going hysterical about Obama doing the same thing with Obamacare. If you don't like it, pass a law. Pass a law saying that the president cannot delay implementation of the employer mandate. And then he will have to pass a law. You've got the power. The Constitution gave the power to you, Congressman Sessions, not to the courts. But we understand that your agenda is not suing the president or getting him to behave according to the Constitution. Your agenda is to tie him up 16 ways to Sunday so he can't accomplish anything. So as our economy collapses over the next couple of years, you can blame it all on the president. We get it. Increasingly, the American people get it. Whether it's going to be successful for you or not, time will tell. But we're getting it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I'm astounded that one of the leaders of the caucus room conspiracy, Pete Sessions, had the temerity to come out in front of the cameras and say, we're going to take down this president. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dan in Minneapolis, you wanted to disagree with my characterization of conservatives?
Hello.
Yeah, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
What? So my
show, probably the second time I listened to it, and I thought I think you really struck an interest you were to mention to try to describe the difference between conservatism and liberalism.
Right.
And I think it's a great discussion. I really truthfully do. I was driving. I wasn't taking a lot of notes. I'm just a plumber. I work for myself. I'm not an expert on a lot of things. But I do take issue with one example you made.
Mm-hmm.
And that was conservatives don't want to raise the minimum wage because, and I think you said just screw them, the people who don't make as much money as the rest of us.
Yeah, that's hyperbole. You're right.
Yeah. And I think
conservatives don't want to raise the minimum wage because they believe in this mythical sky god thing called the free market, and that the right to contract, which is in the Constitution, should be omnipotent, and that if government does not interfere in that so-called free marketplace, then everything will be wonderful. The reality is that every time we've tried that, we end up with something called Somalia.
Well, let me share with you what I think, and then this is how I perceive it.
Sure.
What's wonderful about not having a minimum wage is, for example, my son who just turned 17 can get a job in the summer where he can learn how to work for somebody he doesn't know, how to work for managers he may not like,
mm-hmm.
how to work, show up for work, et cetera, gain work experience. I think one of the problems we have as conservatives with a minimum wage is that we're giving people money that they haven't necessarily acquired experience or expertise to earn.
Okay, I don't disagree with you. And we used to have a solution to that back when America was being run by rational Republicans. You know, this was a leftover from the Eisenhower era and the Nixon era. When I was 14 years old, I was still living at home, going to either junior high school or high school. And I got a job. I wanted to go out in the workplace, right? I wanted to have an after school job. My Henry's Hamburgers, which was a hamburger chain that lasted for a few years, and I was 14, it must have been 1965. Henry's Hamburgers in Lansing was the closest place to my house where I could get a job, and they offered me a job at less than the minimum wage. But in order to get that job, I had to get from the city of Lansing a work permit. My dad had to sign some paperwork saying that it was fine with him that a minor work, number one, and it was also fine with him and with me that I'd be paid less than the minimum wage. Because back then, the minimum wage was the equivalent of about $13 an hour in today's dollars. The minimum wage has not been indexed to inflation.
What year was that in?
Pardon?
What year was that in?
That was in 1965. And okay. and I worked at minimum wage jobs. In 68 I started in radio. I was working as a DJ. Maybe it was 67. I was 16. It was 67. I got a job as a weekend DJ at WITL. I was working at Bob's Big Boy. I pumped gas. I eventually, by the time I was 16, 17, I moved out of the house when I was 16. And I was on my own. But I could make a living on a minimum wage. And that, at that point, being 16, I didn't need a work permit anymore, and they weren't allowed to pay me less than the minimum wage, which back at that time I think was like $1.35 an hour or something. And
when you said you were on your own, did you live by yourself and have a car and all that too, or what?
Yeah, I lived in East Lansing. I didn't have a car, but I had my own apartment on Grand River Avenue right across the street from MSU. It cost me $35 a month. I still remember.
Sure. Well, I guess my point, and I don't want to interrupt you, I'm just, because I know you probably want to take other callers, but I think another thing it does, without being an expert, it raises the cost of living for all of the rest of us whose wages have not raised because of the minimum wage.
The evidence doesn't demonstrate that.
You know what I'm saying? It's not like everyone else's wages are going to go up proportionately.
But Dan, the evidence does not show that. We have had a minimum wage since 1935. We've raised it, 20 some odd times. And every time the minimum wage has been raised, there has not been a general increase in inflation and there has not been a general decrease in the workforce. Instead, what happens is because minimum wage workers spend typically 100 to 105% of their income, they over time go in debt using credit cards and things, because they spend all of their income, when their wage goes up, they stimulate the local economy. There's more money that is injected into the local economy, which creates more demand, which creates more jobs. Every time the minimum wage goes up, jobs go up.
Can I tell you that really just defies common sense?
But it is.
I'm not saying you're not telling the truth. I'm just saying it defies common sense because there's only so much money in the economy. If a business
not
has
true.
To pay more in wages, they have less profitability, and that money that would have been a profit could also be dispensable income in the community.
No, no. So here's how it works, Bob. Or Dan, here's what you're missing. That extra money that for example, Walmart is making by not paying their workers the same that Costco does. Costco pays people doing the exact same job as the Walmart people, pays them $40,000 a year. Walmart is paying $9 an hour. The difference is that the five heirs to the Walmart fortune are worth $100 billion, whereas the founders of Costco are worth a few hundred million dollars. So where that money goes is not into the local economy like it does when you raise the minimum wage and you actually stimulate the economy. Instead, that money goes into the Swiss bank accounts of the Walmart heirs.
But are you saying that if we raise the minimum wage, even at Walmart, that there will not be any increases in prices for all of us that shop there, the millions of people that benefit from going to Walmart?
By and large, yes. That's what I'm saying, and that's what history shows. I'm telling you, Dan, if there was any time in – we've had this minimum wage experiment going on for four generations. It's been going on since 1935. And if there was even one year the Republicans could point to and say, remember back in 1974, we raised the minimum wage by 21%, and oh, my God, we saw unemployment go down 3%. We saw inflation go up 5%. If there was even one year that they could point to – people would have memorized it like a mantra the same way they have Ronald Reagan's name.
Can I ask you one question? Why isn't there, then, a competitor that would run Walmart out of business, that would pay their people more and do what people on the left wish, and then it would be win-win for everybody, the consumer, the employee, the business?
Right. I mean, the reason why is the same.
What's preventing that from happening?
That's a very good question. What is preventing that from happening is monopoly. Is that prior to the 1980s, prior to 83, our government enforced the Sherman Antitrust Act. And we said businesses cannot grow so large that they prevent competition in their marketplace. We know, you know, it's not even a matter of dispute that when a Walmart opens, about 120 local businesses are going to close over the next 5 to 10 years. And
but there are targets. There's targets. There's, like you said, there's other departments.
I understand, but they tend to be an oligopoly. They tend to be
doing that.
They tend to be, you know, what has happened since Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act and the other antitrust laws is that in every sector, in our food sector, for example, 90% of the food that we eat is sold to us by one of 10 companies, either sold to directly to us or by them. They own all those brands. In our media, when Reagan came into office, there were over 1,000 companies that owned 90% of the media that we read, hear, and watch. Now you've got 5 companies that own over, 7,000 magazines, own all the networks, own most of the major newspapers, 5 companies. If you look at food, Archer's Daniel Midland and Cargill, and there's one other company, I'm forgetting the name of them, control about 80% of the raw food, or not raw food, but, you know, the wheat, corn, rice, rye, all that kind of thing. And it's the same thing in retailing. In big box retailing, apparently you're not old enough to remember this, Bob, but I'm an old fart. I can remember before Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act, and the downtown of East Lansing in 1965 when I was living there, or 68 when I was living there, the downtown was nothing but locally owned stores. I lived over Jacobson's, which was a furniture store that was owned by the Jacobson family. It was in the second generation of their family. My wife went to school with one of their kids. There's nothing there anymore. You know, and that was true of every small town in America. The local malls were strip malls with all kinds of little small companies. Now it's nothing but chains.
But you know what? Now I'm a plumber. I go buy parts. If I go to the local hardware store, which I'm happy to do, I'm paying 2 to 3 times more for the identical product that I can get
exactly right
at a big box store.
Exactly right.
I and the consumer win.
No, you don't win. What's happened is that these big box stores have rigged the game. So it looks to you like you're winning, but you're actually being screwed, because what they're doing as they're lowering prices is they're also lowering the wage base, which includes your wages. They're lowering what people can afford to pay a plumber when they call and hire. They're 30 years ago, talk to somebody who was a plumber 30 years ago. You could make a good living. A good union plumber would have the equivalent of $60,000 a year in today's money and income.
I know, but the consumer loses when you have to pay plumbers.
No, because the consumers were getting decent paychecks. Because the minimum wage was $13 an hour.
But their quality of life could be better if there was, you know, that's a whole nother.
No, you're making the argument that Walmart tries to make. And back when Walmart started, by the way, I in the early 80s when we moved to Atlanta, I remember one of the first Walmarts opened and Sam Walton was still alive, and it was 100% made in the USA, you may recall.
Yeah.
And that was a different business model than today's Walmart. But
I know, but we all save money at the bottom line for families if they can buy.
No, you're saying just because we can buy more cheap crap from China, we're better off. And that's not true, because
that's up to the individual.
Let me just put it into a simple bumper sticker. I would be glad to pay 5% more at Walmart if my paycheck is 20% larger, because that's how it works.
It's ultimately up to you to make your paycheck larger, not the rest of us.
No, the labor market does not exist in a vacuum. It's government policy, by and large, that defines it. They define the marketplace. They define the rules of the game. It's like football. Somebody's got to come up with the rules of the game. It's the NFL. In the case of the labor market, it's the government. Dan, thanks
for
the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
That was a very thoughtful conversation. It's great to hear from people who either disagree with me or... Well, let's just leave it at that. Thanks, Dan.
No, it's not your fault. It's entirely mine.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you as I rewire my head. I thought I had a break that I don't have. Let's see here. Tom, in Waterloo, Iowa, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish satellite, and now I can hear you in my ear. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom, just a couple quick conversations on the conservative mindset. It seems to me that in a lot of cases, the conservative/Republicans are always talking about taking the money that would normally go directly to the social services and giving it to the churches and other private organizations in an attempt to provide us our social services.
Right.
But the problem we've had in the past is forced indoctrination. A perfect example of that would be from Oliver Twist, the Charles Dickens novel. I mean, it's in some cases, it's all right horrid. The same thing can also be said for the privatization of our school system and the general corporate mindset in general. I mean, they're real big on indoctrination. I worked for a company in Wisconsin that was very conservative, and oh, geez, you wouldn't believe the ideas they drilled into our head in order to get us to keep a paycheck.
They had like company-wide meetings where they would practice preach doctrine at you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was mostly anti-union indoctrination and so on and so forth. And,
wow.
You know, their so-called company values and, you know, God bless the investor and all that other stuff.
Right.
It was pretty creepy.
Yeah, that's amazing. Thank you, Tom. Thanks for the call. That's pretty amazing. Bob in Sacramento, California. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
Good show today. I wanted to talk a little bit about the true political spectrum. We get this idea that liberal and conservative are the left-right dichotomy.
Right.
And
it's actually a spectrum.
I don't really think that's the way it is. I think liberal is the true center of the political spectrum. And that people want conditions to get generally better. They want representative democracy, and that's what liberalism is. The Constitution is a liberal document.
Right.
And on the left, you have progressives who want more rapid change for social justice, and on the conservatives, you want prudent change.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So the near right is conservative. The near left is progressive. Then you get, on the right, you get individualism to the right of conservative.
Right.
And on the left, you get socialism on the left of progressive. And then you get fascist totalitarianism on the far right and communist totalitarianism on the far left.
You're absolutely right.
But the Overton window has changed to the point where fascism is conservative and liberal is the far left.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely
right.
And
it's just not so.
Yeah.
You know, we have to change the dialogue to reflect what the true political spectrum actually is.
Yes. You did a really, really good job of identifying what's called framing. And you know, it's the frame is how you see things and what you – it's like – And where that, you said Overton window, what is that?
Well, that's, you hear that, I'm surprised you haven't heard that. It's a, Bart Kopp used to use that term a fair amount. There's some Overton guy that, you know, when you frame things and you move the window to, and I guess his name was Overton.
Yeah,
and then
I'll have to look it up.
To the left and the right, and
right.
And you see what you see through the window.
I got it. I'll check it out. Bob, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. We'll be back. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartman here with you, helping you win the water cooler wars. And John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hi, how are you doing? I just wanted to say that I kind of have a different take on liberal. I also want to mention what's going on in Israel, but I'd like to talk about this issue really quickly. But liberality is actually an old-fashioned virtue, and it comes from the Catholic Church, and it means to be generous and open and share.
Right.
And if that's, you know, what liberality is, I think it's a good thing, and liberals need to be aware of that. And that's one of the reasons why, I mean, I'm probably somewhat left of progressive compared to other people, but I do believe in liberality. And I also would like to say, as far as Hobbes is concerned, that I don't want to have a king. But I believe in the nobility of ordinary people.
Yes.
You know, nobility is a good thing, and we should be, you know, reaching for those virtues however we can. And it used to be liberal education was a way to do it, reading great books, listening to people like yourself in these conversations that you have. I've learned quite a bit about Hobbes and both Locke, which I'm very ignorant of, and I'd like to explore more. But that is how we develop this generous spirit. And I, you know, Amy Goodman is a good example. I mean, you know, can you imagine, she's a voice in the wilderness in, you know, there in New York, because I would say that the Jewish community probably anathematizes her every day. You know, they probably are not real happy, but...
Well, there's there's not a homogenous Jewish community. I mean, Amy, for that matter, is Jewish herself.
Because I grew up in a Jewish community. Yeah. But let me tell you something. In Israel, only maybe 15 or 20% are truly on the left of the spectrum. And that's what I wanted to mention. I really appreciate the courage, because I think liberality leads to courage, because people are informed and they know the issues and they know they have a generous spirit towards everyone. Right. And I would like to mention especially Yonatan Shapiro, who is part of the group of 27 pilots who refused to fly last time with the last engagement of Gaza. And then I also would like to mention her name is Yael Evan Orr, who is a journalist and a student at the New School of Social Research, which incidentally was started by Jews who left Nazi Germany. So, right. You know, there isn't a homogenous community, but the reason that there is, I think, is because of liberalism. I think, frankly, in my opinion, and you don't have to agree with me, after living, you know, 58 years, I think that the liberals of the morality and the ethics, and generally what happens as people get more conservative, they move towards militarism, they move towards totalitarianism and Nazism,
and toward
fascism.
A certain type of selfishness. John, here is John Kennedy talking about this in 1960 about what liberal means.
What do our opponents mean when they apply to us the label liberal? If by liberal they mean, as they want people to believe, someone who is soft in his policies abroad, who is against local government, and who is unconcerned with a taxpayer's dollar, then the record of this party and its members demonstrate that we are not that kind of liberal. But if by a liberal they mean someone who looks ahead and not behind, someone who welcomes new ideas without rigid reactions, someone who cares about the welfare of the people, their health, their housing, their schools, their jobs, their civil rights and their civil liberties, someone who believes that we can break through the stalemate and suspicions that grip us in our policies abroad, if that is what they mean by a liberal, then I'm proud to say that I'm a liberal.
So, John, is that what you were talking about?
Yes, absolutely. I just wanted to make one point about conservatism, though. I think the way that conservatism, or the way that conservatives describe themselves or identify themselves today, is not at all as, you know, conservatives have identified themselves, say, in the 19th century. You know, they're not holding on to any of those noble aristocratic...
No, I totally agree, John. Barry Goldwater would not recognize the Republican Party right now. And I know that from having read both of his autobiographies and having worked on his 64 campaign. Barry Goldwater would not, you know, he famously said you don't have to be straight to shoot straight. John, I got to run along. I want to get a couple more callers in here before we run out of time. But excellent points. Kurt in Los Angeles. Hey, Kurt, what's up?
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I know we got short on time, so let me try to be quick. Your two callers ago, your gentleman, and he's asking why can't some other company then compete with Walmart and drive them out of business if they're so bad. Well, let me explain my personal experience with Walmart. I've been trying to open up a little family fun center in my neck of the woods. I live in a suburb outside of L.A. proper. And I've discovered that Walmart, after they come in and dominate a particular shopping center, there's this thing called a CR&R. I'm not sure if that's the correct acronym or not, but there's these conditions and something that commercial property owners have to adhere to when one anchor store, you know, has conditions. And Walmart puts these ridiculous conditions that no other competitive type business can go in within certain miles of the shopping center, no bowling centers, no entertainment places, no movie theaters, no other disposable income businesses can come in after Walmart.
Wow.
In fact, Walmart went from being a regular store to a super center. You know, super centers cropped up in mid-2000s.
Yeah, they're now one of the largest suppliers of groceries in the United States.
Right. But they left their old building sitting for 10 years. The empty building next to the super center is fenced around, and a grocery store, a bowling, a nice family fun center.
Kurt, I'm sorry we're out of time, but thank you for sharing your story with us. And this, it's exactly what I was talking about. Coming up tomorrow, it's Friday. That means Brunch with Bernie, America's Senator. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. Plus, anything goes Friday. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. You do need to get involved. Go to pdamerica.org or movetoamend.org. There's all kinds of great organizations out there. Find one, get active, and occupy something. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.